Okay, everybody, good evening. Our topic for tonight is American Jewry, President Roosevelt, and the refugee crisis. Ordinarily, I would say you can unmute yourself at any time and ask a question. However, I'm going to make a request of everyone tonight that this week and next week, when we discuss this most sensitive of topics, that you actually save your questions for the end. I'd like to go through my whole spiel for about 50, 55 minutes, and then we'll take the questions at the end, because I know that it'll get very feisty. This is the most sensitive topic in all of American Jewish history, without a doubt. Okay, so you can write in the chat if you'd like, but just don't unmute yourself until the end. So the American Jewish community's response to the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust is the most controversial aspect of American Jewish history. The related matter of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's actions and inactions are also the subject of intense debate. Among the leading mainstream historians, David Wyman, who passed away about a year ago, was Roosevelt's biggest critic. He was the author of Paper Walls and The Abandonment of the Jews. Both are books that I highly recommend, and the content of which we'll review next week. Paper Walls and The Abandonment of the Jews. Okay, two very important books. In the same camp is Rafi Medoff, who recently published The Jews Should Keep Quiet, about Stephen Wise, Franklin Roosevelt, and the Holocaust. Again, critical of Roosevelt, but also very, very critical of Stephen Wise, calling him basically a fool. Other scholars, notably Michael Maris and David Cesarani, considered FDR a bystander to the Holocaust, which is not a nice term to use. A bystander implies like the Germans who didn't do anything but just watched as people went to the gas chambers. Other scholars, for example, Alexander Groth, who's a Holocaust survivor, wrote about Churchill and FDR as accomplices. That's even worse than a bystander. So in the scholarly literature and in the popular literature, you have all sorts of besmirchment, whether rightly or wrongly, I'm not here to say just yet, of Roosevelt and of elements of the Jewish leadership. Yet there are others who defend the president, or at least focus on exculpatory evidence. For example, William Rubinstein wrote The Myth of Rescue, Why the Democracies Could Not Have Saved More Jews from the Nazis. The theme of that book is basically, while it's true that the Western democracies could have done a lot more than they actually did, even had they done more, they wouldn't have saved more people. That the capacity of the Westerners to save was not as great as the capacity of the Nazis to kill, and so ultimately much effort was for naught, even if more had been tried. Henry Feingold, the professor at CUNY, was the first to write any serious book on this, The Politics of Rescue, back in 1970. And he blamed FDR for being a fair-weather friend of the Jews, yet assigns much greater blame not to the president, but to underlings, notably Assistant Secretary of State Breckinridge Long, who was the leader of the pack of the anti-Semites in the State Department. When we shift the focus away from politicians and shine a spotlight on American Jewry itself, so we have Rabbi Haskell Lookstein's doctoral dissertation from 1977, which became a book titled, Were We Our Brother's Keepers? The Public Response of American Jews to the Holocaust, 1938 to 1944. In Rabbi Lookstein's view, even if the Shoah was unstoppable, it should have been unbearable. It should have been unbearable from a psychological point of view for American Jewry. Now, bear in mind, he was born in America in 1932 and lived in Manhattan at the center of the action of American Jewish life, his father, his great-grandfather. And so his perspective was, we couldn't stop it, but it wasn't unbearable. And I remember being in his homiletics class when he spoke about this one time, and he said, what did we do in the summer of 1941? Okay, we went to Ebbets Field and Yankee Stadium to watch the World Series while the Einsatzgruppen were killing Jews in Europe, in the Ukraine. So there was a disconnect between what was happening in Europe and what was happening in America, in New York, where people were enjoying a summer full of baseball. Okay. Franklin Delano Roosevelt explicitly condemned anti-Semitism during the 1932 presidential campaign. He opposed calls for registration of aliens. That had always been a sensitive subject. The creating of lists, the registration of aliens. He opposed that. He generally supported the prior administration, the Hoover administration's immigration policies, but said that they needed to be implemented with tact, discretion, and human understanding. Kind of reminds me of George Bush II's compassionate conservatism, except this is coming from Roosevelt. Hoover did not appeal to Jews because he did not formally condemn anti-Semitism. He also favored a tight immigration policy and did not pursue liberal economics. So that's why you weren't going to have a lot of Jews voting for and enthusiastically endorsing Herbert Hoover in the 32 election. Still, Felix Warburg endorsed Hoover and pointed to the appointment by Hoover of Benjamin Cardozo to the Supreme Court. Here, he appointed a Jew to the High Court. Stephen Wise, and this is sort of a forgotten point of history, Stephen Wise did not support Roosevelt for election 1932, did not support his nomination, and does not support him in the general election. But ever the opportunist, Rabbi Stephen Wise was, he wrote to FDR a congratulatory note and began to kiss up to the new president as soon as the election results were in. So Stephen Wise, as you can tell, is not one of my favorites in the study of Jewish history. He's up there with Isaac Meir Wise, no relation but the same last name, as people I'm not too fond of. Okay. There was an attempt to broker a joint statement by outgoing President Hoover and incoming President Franklin Roosevelt condemning the Nazi rise to power in February of 33. Bear in mind that the election in Germany was January 30th of 1933, and the Nazis win a substantial number of seats, and through machinations of Hitler getting President von Hindenburg to crown him the chancellor. So the Nazis take over government, but then you have the Reichstag fire late in February, and then there's another election in March where the Nazis win 44% of the vote, and that's the end of German democracy. So Hoover is still in charge in America for one more month after the Nazi takeover. And there was a thought of having a joint statement of the two administrations, Hoover and Roosevelt, saying, no, Nazi Germany is bad. However, it did not materialize for a variety of reasons, one of which was Roosevelt wanted to have nothing to do with Hoover and have a clean, a fresh start, a clean break in terms of foreign policy. Roosevelt did not want to have to deal with an international crisis in the early days of his presidency. You know, when Roosevelt was elected in November of 32, so the Nazis were just a fringe party in Germany at that point. The thought wasn't that they were going to take over. So Roosevelt had all these ideas in his mind about domestic policy agenda for economics and the New Deal for his first 100 days. He doesn't want that getting sidetracked with dealing with a dictator across the ocean. And he worried about his domestic agenda, Roosevelt. He feared that if he veered too far off the course on foreign policy, then the New Deal coalition, which had thrust him into the presidency, would collapse. Also, we have to bear in mind that there was Jewish disunity, and that prevented a unified Jewish response. There already was, for a variety of other reasons, Jewish disunity between Zionist and non-Zionist, Reform and Orthodox, different political factions. The Jews were not of one voice, uptown and downtown, German Jews versus Eastern European. So when a crisis is brewing, there is no one organization or one person who represents American Jewry to speak to the president. The B'nai B'rith and the American Jewish Committee, meaning the old German Jewish elite, the uptown crowd, preferred quiet diplomacy with the American administration and to help for German Jews, Joint Distribution Committee. So cash help to our brethren overseas. And they wanted a broad alliance with Gentiles against German fascism. In other words, it should not be said that only the Jews are against the Nazis, but rather it should be said that all of peace-loving humanity is against the Nazis. So let's get the Gentiles involved. Okay, well, the American Jewish Committee and that crowd, they opposed rallies, boycotts, and noisemaking on the theory that if you do too much of that, you're likely to stoke anti-Semitism in America and further imperil the Jews in Germany. In other words, it'll backfire. It'll make it worse here, and it'll make it much worse there. You're not going to be helping anybody by making a lot of noise. So what to do? Making a ruckus in this perspective would confirm the suspicions that Jews really do control the world. You know, the anti-Semites, they would like everyone to believe, ah, the Jews have too much power. They can pull the strings from behind the curtain. Well, if the American Jewish Committee's perspective was, if you have a lot of boisterous Jews, you know, people are going to think that's really true, even though it's not true. But to do nothing is also not a good idea, because to do nothing is silence is acquiescence. You know, shtika kehoda, as we say in the Gemara. So what, you're going to say that Nazi Germany is fine? There's nothing we can do about it? On March 22nd, Cyrus Adler, and we've spoken a lot about Cyrus Adler. He was the president of JTS and president of Dropsy, and he was a big macho in the American Jewish Committee. So he condemned mass meetings and claimed that his contacts inside of Germany told him that mass meetings in the United States was likely to hurt Jewish interests on the ground in Germany. So did Hayas go into hibernation? Asher is asking. So the answer to that is Hayas did not go into hibernation, but there wasn't a lot for them to do because people couldn't get into the country. What if they could get in, they would help them. But the numbers that were able to enter were pitiful, as I'll say soon enough. Eli was asking, was the opposition to mass meetings and gatherings and protests to protect themselves? So the answer to that is yes, in the sense that if you really believe there would be a pogrom in America if Jews got too out of hand, then yeah, you wouldn't want that. So if your estimation of the possibility for American anti-Semitism was that it's very sinister and lurking, you know, and ready to explode, then yes, this is a self-preservation. Okay, so what happened? Adler condemned mass gatherings, but Stephen Wise, ever the player on the scene, says we got to have one. We got to get a mass rally together. So he begged Governor Herbert Lehman to speak at a rally on March 27th at Madison Square Garden. Lehman declined, thinking it wasn't a good idea. In part, it's because Lehman was a company man and was devoted to Roosevelt, who had elevated Lehman up to the governorship, and Roosevelt had whispered, I don't want you to do this. Wise claimed that there had to be a rally under his auspices, Dafka his auspices. Why Dafka Stephen Wise? Well, very self-serving, of course. Because if it's not me, then there's going to be a rally. And who's going to run the rally? The left-wing radical socialists. So better it should be me, a representative of mainstream Jewish life, than some Meshuggah socialists running the rally. Was he wrong? I don't know. Maybe he was right about that. I couldn't say. So what happened on March 27th, 1933? 20,000 people gathered at Madison Square Garden. If you go on Google Images for 1933 Madison Square Garden rally, Jewish, you'll see a picture of packed to the rafters of the old garden. This was the garden that was on 8th Avenue between 49th and 50th Streets, not the one that's in Penn Station today. This is Madison Square Garden number 2, the one that was around from 25 to 68. Okay, so 20,000 people were at the garden. And another 35,000 were outside lining 8th Avenue all the way to Columbus Circle, 59th Street in the corner of Central Park South. Then there were 10,000 people in Brooklyn and in all other cities around America. It is claimed that upwards of 1 million people participated in anti-Nazi rallies in all the various cities in the United States that day. Who spoke at the New York City rally, the big one? So this reminds me of like the Siyum HaShas. It's the Siyum HaShas in every different city, but the big one is at Madison Square Garden. This was to oppose the Nazis in 1933. So the speakers were Senator Wagner, Robert Wagner, Al Smith, the former governor and former candidate for president, Mayor O'Brien, and Methodist bishops. There were simultaneous protests everywhere. And now who was missing from this rally? What was missing was our crowd, the rich German Jewish elite. Also, the Catholic Church was missing, and the black community was missing. Despite the Jews founding the NAACP and being at the forefront of black civil rights, blacks were nowhere to be found as allies in the American Jewish fight against the Shoah, against Nazism. Why? So for two reasons that have nothing to do with each other. One was that the blacks brought nothing to the table. They had no political power, so their presence would not be a show of strength in any way. And secondly, because there was already in the 1930s, early 30s, tensions between landlords and tenants. That is the thorn in the side of black Jewish relations for the next 100 years, are tenant landlord relations in Harlem and elsewhere. And so Reddy's relations are not so great. Okay, the mainstream newspapers in America did cover the protests and did cover the Nazi takeover of Germany, and that covered the fact that the Nazi government had been trying to oust Jews from the civil service and from public life. So lest you think that American newspapers buried the Holocaust, and some did, at least in the early 1930s and 33, they did not bury the story. It was front page in a lot of newspapers. It was a big deal. And both Stephen Wise in the American Jewish Congress crowd and Cyrus Adler in the American Jewish Committee crowd were satisfied with press accounts of the events of the day. The Nazis responded to American Jewish protests by announcing a one-day boycott of German Jewish businesses. There's a question in the chat: with the Bundestag marches a big factor in Jewish worries about a backlash? Okay, so the answer is yes, in the sense that, what was going on in Berlin was scaring people. The fact is that Jews were already unsafe on the streets as early as 1933. I mean, it wasn't as bad as it would be in 35 or 38 or 39, but it was getting bad. And the boycott, the one-day boycott on April 1st, 1933, by the Nazis of Jewish businesses, the fear was this would extend indefinitely and totally ruin German Jews' economic circumstance. As it turned out, it didn't continue, but there were further restrictions imposed upon Jews. So yes, there are real concerns about what's happening on the street in Germany. So the American Jewish Committee types, notably Judge Joseph Proskauer, worried that protests were interfering with American intentions in foreign policy and with regard to arms control in the global economy. In other words, that America has issues with Germany that don't pertain to Jewish civil rights. There are issues of arms control, trying to avoid another war, and there's issues of trade relations. And the Roosevelt administration worries about these things and doesn't want them getting bogged down with Jewish issues. So Proskauer said, "We are Americans first and must be loyal to America above all else." That kind of statement in light of the Shoah sounds, like treasonous. But in the moment, he was trying to be a good American. America has its foreign policy to worry about, and it can't overly emphasize Jewish parochial concerns. But who disagreed? Who was very strongly in favor of a tough line against Germany? The answer is the Jewish war veterans of World War I. The American Jewish War Veterans Association, which were the veterans of World War I, were militantly anti-Nazi and wanted a boycott of Germany. They were led by the attorney Samuel Untermeyer, and he set up the Non-Sectarian Anti-Nazi League. Now, when we say non-sectarian, what does that mean? It means
non-Jews.
It's a bunch of Jews, but we don't want to say that it's Jewish. We want to say that it's non-sectarian and that a couple of goyim are involved, and maybe they are involved, but it's in our interest to say that this isn't just a Jewish venture. So Non-Sectarian Anti-Nazi League. The goyim, too, are involved. Okay. And the idea is this is a battle for civilization, and it's irrespective of one's creed or ethnicity that you should be anti-Nazi because it's the right thing to do. Wise tried to play it both ways. At first, he opposed the boycott, and then he supported it. Hadassah and the American Federation of Labor supported the boycott. But in truth, Germany exported very little to the United States, and the boycott was going to have no meaningful impact on the German economy. The Zionist organization established the Havara Agreement, the transfer agreement, which we spent a lot of time discussing last year in the course on Zionism. So Havara was the exact opposite of a boycott. It was you take Jewish money, which is being ransomed, effectively taken, held hostage, you transfer some of it to Eretz Yisrael, and in return, Eretz Yisrael gets to buy German products to build up its infrastructure. So the Germans make money in their industrial base, and Eretz Yisrael gets industrial goods, but the money stays in Germany. So this is the antithesis of boycott. Stephen Wise, a leader of American Zionism, regarded the Havara Agreement as a filthy and inexcusable breaking of the United Jewish Front against Germany. So here we see, we should have a united front, but we don't. And there's horrible machlokas over what to do. So the real question was, from a political point of view, would FDR condemn the Nazi government in the first year of his tenure, in 33 and even into 34? So there were conflicting indications as to what FDR would do in 1933. But in the end, he had larger fish to fry with Germany. And so the Jew policy had to be put on the back burner, and he did not condemn the Nazi government. Cordell Hull was the Secretary of State. And he firmly backed the principle of American non-intervention in the domestic affairs of foreign countries. That's a mouthful. But remember, we already discussed this once before, or maybe even more than once before. Remember, we discussed the Tsarist Russia and American Jews trying to get the American government in the days of President Grant and then President Garfield and then President McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt to condemn Tsarist Russia for the pogroms of 1881, of Kishinev, of 1906. And the American policy long was, we don't say boo about the moral misdeeds of foreign countries vis-a-vis their own citizens internally. And why don't we do that in America? Well, because we had slavery until 1865, and we had Jim Crow until 1965. So who are we to condemn anybody else when we're, you know, causing the blacks to suffer, the Native Americans, the Japanese, whatever it is. America has a lot of averas that it doesn't want to talk about. So how can we talk about somebody else's sin if we have our own? Best just to say nothing about it. So that was a longstanding American policy that did not change until, you know, deep into the 20th century. Cordell Hull also had a Jewish wife, but that didn't really help much in terms of convincing him to take an active role in favor of rescue. Hull was a free trader who didn't want human rights getting in the way of trade deals. He also was a Southerner. He was from Tennessee, but considered a Southerner. And he was a rare example of an official in the Roosevelt administration. You know, Roosevelt is a Democrat, so his cabinet was it was all Democrats. But most of these Democrats were Northern or Northeastern Democrats whose rise to power was totally tied to Roosevelt selecting them for the job. As opposed to Cordell Hull, as a Southern Democrat, had an independent political base that Roosevelt had to cater to as part of the New Deal coalition. It's an important thing to remember. Like in Israel, every member of the cabinet has his own constituency that elected him to the Knesset. You know, if you're the Minister of the Interior, the Minister of Finance, Minister whatever, you're not entirely beholden to Bibi, because even though he appointed you, but he needed your votes in the Knesset. In America, the cabinet is just appointees of the president, so they have no power independent of the president. But if the president's winning coalition necessitates your presence because of demographic considerations or regional considerations, you have some sway. Okay, well, the State Department was heavily WASPy and patrician. They resisted any suggestion of presidential or diplomatic rebuke of Nazi Germany. They resisted it. Okay, and so it didn't happen right away. It would not happen for a while. Stephen Wise, realizing that the March 27th rally didn't get the job done, decides, let's do it again. You know, he's paying a rental agreement to Madison Square Garden. He paid more rent than the Rangers did. So on May 10th, he arranged another rally, the same day that the Nazis were burning objectionable books. But it didn't really work out. FDR proposed a non-aggression deal with Germany in the middle of May 33 and congratulated himself for avoiding war. Now, there was no non-aggression deal signed, but in other words, there was diplomatic talk, and the fear of an imminent war dissipated. Felix Warburg, a Republican, wanted Roosevelt to be silent on the German-Jewish issue. But Roosevelt wasn't likely to listen to a lifelong Republican like Warburg, unless Warburg was telling FDR exactly what FDR wanted to hear. And I think he wanted to hear, shh, don't say anything. So FDR was willing to let Congress condemn Nazi Germany, but he would not back a formal resolution. The question only would be, is Congress willing to act? The trouble from a Jewish point of view is Congress, 435 representatives, and at that time, 96 senators, was filled with nativists, immigration restrictionists, down and out bigots. So getting Congress to act was no simple matter and an unlikely matter. Well, there was pressure on FDR knew he could continue to get political support from the Jews, even if he did nothing on the Nazi issue. Why was this the case? Why do the, Eli's asking, what about domestic pro-German feeling in the country? So we're going to get to that. There wasn't that much of it other than among the German crowd, the German-American Bund, but there was an anti-war perspective, which had the functional equivalent of being pro-German, because it meant you let Germany get away with all their aggression. So it's, but people didn't see it that way at the time. FDR understood it, that was the case, but the average rank-and-file American didn't understand that. So FDR knew he could rely upon the Jews for their votes. The Jews were not going to turn to the Republicans. Why not? Because the Republicans were immigration restrictionists and were WASPy elitists and were palling around with domestic anti-Semites. So it wasn't likely that a substantial percentage of American Jews were going to vote Republican. If that's the case, then why should FDR risk political capital on behalf of the Jews when he has their vote in his pocket? He won't. He doesn't want to become a one-term president like Hoover and risk his domestic agenda. So the New Deal coalition necessitated not focusing on minority affairs. So despite not really doing anything to counter the Germans, the Nazis nonetheless regarded Roosevelt as a friend of the Jews. So Roosevelt had it like coming from both angles. The Germans said that Roosevelt was a friend of the Jews. And the anti-Semites in America said Roosevelt is a friend of the Jews. But precisely because that's where the criticism is coming from, but the criticism is not coming from the Jews, Roosevelt can afford to not be all that friendly. It's an unfortunate political constellation that worked against the Jews' interests. There was public pressure on Roosevelt to revoke President Hoover's 1930 executive order instructing the State Department to interpret the likely public charge, the LPC clause of the immigration laws, as a possibly public charge. So let me clarify what I'm talking about here. A couple of weeks back, we discussed the immigration laws, the 1917, 1921, 1924. Okay, and one of the most important clauses in the 24 legislation was that if a person was likely to become a public charge, meaning to go on welfare, that person should not be given an immigration visa. That even if they're under the quota system, they're allowed to come in because there's room for them in the quota. Still, if this particular individual is likely to become a public charge, the consular officials around the world were not supposed to issue that person a visa. So in 1930, as unemployment is skyrocketing and the Great Depression is intensifying in Hoover's second year in office, he issued an executive order saying that instead of a likely public charge, LPC, anyone who's possibly going to become a public charge should be denied. Well, guess what? Even if I'm a millionaire, I might be possibly a public charge. What happens if I invested in some dot-com and it blew up and I lost all my money? Or the 1930 equivalent of that. So even a person with real wealth could, in theory, lose his money in some scheme and become possibly a public charge. So consular officials under Herbert Hoover's order were basically at liberty to reject people for no good reason. And that was the whole point. We don't want immigrants because there's a depression here. Okay, well, so the pressure was to change that interpretation because after all, the quota was not being filled. The quota for Germany was 20 some odd thousand, and yet very, very few, less than 1,000 came in 1932. Obstructionist State Department functionaries pretended like the quota was the problem, but really it was the public charge clause that was at issue. The State Department officials found an old order from President Woodrow Wilson, which had been signed in 1918, objecting to American consuls abroad, determining whether a country persecutes its citizens, because this would interfere with the president's ability to conduct foreign policy. So let me explain that a little further. The president of the United States is the chief diplomat of the country. He conducts foreign policy. It's part of the Constitution. Consular officials abroad are supposed to execute in real time the policy of the president and of the State Department. But if there is some kind of relaxation of the immigration rules in the case of political refugees where a country is persecuting part of its citizenry, as was the case with the Jews of the Nazi Germany, then there was supposed to be special consideration. Ah, but the consular officials, on the basis of Woodrow Wilson's old order, said, no. We're not at liberty to decide that. Because if we at the level of the consulate in Dusseldorf and Hamburg and Berlin and Bonn, whatever, in Frankfurt, were to make a decision about that, that would impede the president's sole prerogatives of determining American foreign policy. So therefore, we can't figure any of this stuff out. We just have to assume it's not happening. Turn the blind eye. All right. Well, that's not good from a Jewish point of view. Francis Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, was a friend of the Jewish refugee. Was a friend of Jewish refugee immigration, and she denied that there was an economic argument in drastically restricting Jewish immigration. She said, no, it's because the State Department just doesn't want to bring in Jews out of bigotry. But the American economy, from the Labor Department's point of view, is not the issue. So don't think that it's about employment. We could deal with a small influx of refugees. The employment situation would not be exacerbated thereby. So really, it's the State Department that's blocking this. And she battled it out with the State Department. Cordell Hull suggested to his underlings that they draft proposals for Jewish resettlement outside the United States. In other words, if we got to do something for these people, send them elsewhere. Don't send them here. You know, let some other country figure out the problem. However, they balked at coming up with proposals to settle Jews outside the United States because they feared that even that was too far to go in favor of the Jews. It might eventually weaken American immigration restrictions. Felix Frankfurter, who would later go on to become appointed to the court, but at the time was a professor at Harvard and was a friend of Perkins and close to Roosevelt, said about this, "For once in my life, I wish I wasn't a Jew, because then I could more vigorously pursue the refugee issue and not be accused of being parochial, because this is not a Jewish issue. This is a universal humanitarian issue." So this is Frankfurter saying, you know, if I were a goy, I could speak out more forcefully in favor of bringing Jews into the country on the grounds that this is the right thing to do. It's a humanitarian gesture. Okay. Now, there was some limited progress in late 1933, early 1934. Rules were relaxed regarding immediate relatives of those who are American citizens. It became easier to secure a visa if you had an immediate family member who was an American citizen living in America. Also, certain document rules were relaxed. It was the case that you had to get a clean bill of health from the police department wherever you were coming from, and that you had to have your marriage certificate and birth certificate and all sorts of documentation. Well, was it easy for a Jew living in Berlin in 1934 to get from the Gestapo office all these papers? No. So the fact that the American consulates relaxed the paperwork rules was a big deal. It helped a lot of people get into the country. Okay. Organized labor was very much opposed to the relaxing of immigration laws. Now, I said before the AFL supported a boycott of Nazi Germany. They supported a boycott, but they didn't want American Jews coming to America. And the organized labor claimed to speak in the name of 11 million unemployed American citizens, saying, nobody can come here until we have full employment of our own citizens. There was a discussion about putting up bonds for refugees as a guarantee that they would not go on welfare, meaning we'll put in an escrow account, millions and millions of dollars, as a guarantee that if these people who show up do become impoverished, they will not take a federal relief paycheck, but rather they'll take from the escrow account that was accumulated by American Jews. This was based upon a quirk in the 1917 legislation, which in theory would allow this, but the idea went nowhere. Francis Perkins wanted to fill the German quota. The fear was that if the bonding idea went public, Congress would slash the quotas by 40%, or down to 40%. In other words, whatever the quota is, cut 60% off the quota and only allow 40%. So there was a real fear. If the public finds out that we're doing something bureaucratically to let Jews in the country, Congress will drastically change the rules against the interests of the Jews. So you got to keep very, very quiet, lest anything go wrong. There were only 4,392 immigrants under the German quota for the fiscal year ending July 30th, 1934. That was 17% of the total. So this is a shanda, that 83% of the German quota went unfilled. These are real lives of real people who could have been saved, who probably died in the Holocaust because the quota went unfilled and dramatically unfilled. A very small number of scholars was allowed into America outside the quota system. This was the university in exile. And some, you know, famous intellectuals, including Leo Strauss and Bertolt Brecht, a bunch of names of German Jewish intellectuals in the arts and in the sciences were allowed in outside the quota. In the year ending June 30th, 1935, only 5,200 Jews were allowed in under the German quota, 20% of the theoretically allowed total. So it's getting a little bit better, but still horribly and embarrassingly low. Okay. Now, anti-Semitism was becoming a big problem in America. William Dudley Pelley, as I mentioned last week, was the head of the Silver Shirts, and they wanted to remove Jews from power in America. Gerald Winrod of Kansas was known as the Jayhawk Nazi, the Kansas Jayhawks, the Jayhawk Nazi. And he pledged to do battle against the hidden hand of the Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. The remnants of the KKK, which had been big in the 1920s and by the 1930s had been dwindled, but the remnants of the KKK morphed into anti-Semitic groups in hundreds of locales all around the country. The Friends of New Germany was the American branch of the Nazi Party and was being sponsored by the German government to cause trouble. They also held a rally at Madison Square Garden. So the garden was taking rental checks from Jews, taking rental checks from Nazis. They were just taking money wherever they could get it. The Republican Party had activists promoting the following before the 1934 midterms. One God, one country, one religion, one law, one finance, one public school, one language, one vote, one ticket. Now that's a Republican GOP activist basically saying America is a Christian country. We don't want outsiders. We don't want Democrats. We don't want we don't want people who speak foreign languages. One homogenous America, and a homogenous America that doesn't look like you and I. Okay. So FDR was accused by anti-Semitic elements of the population of being a Jew lover, and that he was being advised by Frankfurter's hot dogs. Frankfurter's hot dogs. So who are Frankfurter's hot dogs? Felix Frankfurter, the professor at Harvard, who goes on to become the Supreme Court Justice. So his students, his Talmidim from Harvard, who went on to serve in New Deal agencies, were known as hot dogs. Because Frankfurter hot dog, okay, it was a derisive term. Derisive term. Okay. Well, rising isolationism deterred Roosevelt from criticizing Germany. Not only among Republicans, but even among some liberal Democrats, there was a desire for strict isolationism. And they didn't want to hear Roosevelt stoking the flames of war by criticizing a foreign country and a rising power foreign country at that. James McDonald was appointed the League of Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And the State Department feared that McDonald was going to try to flood America with German Jews. The bottom line is that in the first 2 years of FDR's presidency, he didn't do all that much to help Jews because he couldn't risk his success in other areas. But things change with political fortunes changing. The 1934 midterm elections was a great success for the Democrats. They now controlled over 70% of both the House of Representatives and the Senate. Jews continued to vote for Democrats in overwhelming numbers. And what was FDR's goal after the midterms? Well, to win the 1936 election for the presidency again. And he feared an attack from the left by Huey Long and Father Charles Coughlin, from the sort of the radical left isolationists who wanted to steal money from the rich and give to the poor, but who hated Jews. So Congress passed the Neutrality Act in 1935, and FDR reluctantly signed it. He would have preferred to have wiggle room in dealing with aggressor states abroad, but the American Congress was interested in strict neutrality. Don't get America involved in European conflicts. And so there was another Neutrality Act of 36 and another one in 37, and it imposed a boycott on all belligerents. So this was really bad from a Jewish point of view. It meant that on foreign policy, the American president's hand was tied to do anything of substance to counter the growing threat of Germany. Herbert Lehman pressured FDR in November of 35 to let in several thousand Jewish refugees. What prompted this? The Nuremberg Laws. The Nuremberg Laws of 1935 effectively stripped German Jews of their citizenship. And things were looking really bleak after that. I mean, it would get worse with Kristallnacht, but it was looking bad after the Nuremberg Laws. So let's let a few thousand refugees in. FDR refused, noting that he had already relaxed some of the laws and the document requirements, and he told consuls abroad to give favorable treatment to potential Jewish refugees. So that's all he could do. He couldn't do anything beyond the letter of the law. In fiscal 1936, the total number of Jews that entered was 6,346, barely 25% of the German quota, and well short of a promise of 10,000 that FDR had made a year earlier. But Huey Long was assassinated in September of 1935, by the way, by someone with a Jewish-sounding name, Weiss. Okay, and Jewish immigration remained low in 1936, so the issue did not come to dominate the election cycle, meaning that FDR did not have to worry about a challenge from his own left flank vis-a-vis the Jewish issue. In 1936, Stephen Wise, Rabbi Wise, got to meet FDR several times. But FDR kept deflecting Wise with stories about how Jewish life in Germany wasn't all that bad. He had been heard from Max Warburg that the shuls are crowded in Berlin. You know, they're going to shul, the shuls are crowded. So it was typical Rooseveltian gaslighting. You know, certain presidents are good at gaslighting the public. Roosevelt was good at gaslighting private individuals. Roosevelt made a public statement favoring emigration to Palestine. Why? Because better there than here. You know, nobody really wants Jews, but we don't want them to die. So let them go to Eretz Yisrael. The problem was, what's happening in 1936 in Palestine? The Arab riots. And the British are contemplating severely restricting Jewish immigration. So Roosevelt gets on his bully pulpit and yells at the British, don't restrict Jewish immigration to Palestine. It's their national homeland. So Roosevelt, when it was convenient for him, was a big Zionist. Okay. The 1936 presidential campaign featured accusations of anti-Semitism. And Alf Landon, the Republican candidate, was accused of tolerating the Sentinels and the Crusaders and all the bigots. But the truth is that he really was not an anti-Semite at all. In fact, he had condemned anti-Semitism throughout his career. But the German-American Bund endorsed Landon, claiming that President Rabbi Rosenfeld and his Jewish New Deal was ruining America. So it was easy for the bigots to support the Republican and say, well, we like him better than the Jew Roosevelt. After the 1936 election, Roosevelt was in a greater position to liberalize immigration protocols. The likely public charge clause was changed by administrative fiat in January of 37 to be a probable public charge. So now more and more Jews are going to be allowed in the country. What do we see here? That Roosevelt was not opposed to Jews coming into America, as long as he didn't have to change the laws and get into trouble with Congress. As long as it was not going to hurt him politically, he was willing to be a humanitarian. So FDR, though, kept his fingerprints off this change. He made it seem as though this was just an internal memo among the State Department. For the fiscal year ending in 1937, 10,895 Germans entered under the quota. And it would be even more the year after. FDR gave a famous speech on October 5th, 1937, about a need to quarantine aggressor nations, that Germany is an aggressor state. We have to quarantine them. We have to be able to act against them in order to prevent war. The problem is another Neutrality Act was passed, and Americans were polled, and by overwhelming majority, did not want refugees in the country. 90% wanted no refugees, and they wanted no World War II. That World War I and American involvement in World War I was seen as a historic blunder, not to be repeated. That was popular sentiment in 1937. So FDR was riding high, but there were limits on his power. He couldn't pack the courts. The courts declared unconstitutional some of his New Deal legislation. And in the international realm, his policy preferences were inhibited by a non-compliant Congress. In 1937, Roosevelt replaced William Phillips as the number two in the State Department with Sumner Welles. Sumner Welles was much more of a friend of the Jews than had been William Phillips, who basically was an anti-Semite. Wise encouraged, Franklin Roosevelt encouraged Stephen Wise in 1938, in January, to come up with other potential destinations for Jews to go to aside from Palestine. Meaning if the British are going to close Palestine or severely restrict it, but we want to get Jews out of Europe. You Jews, you Stephen Wise, come up with some other ideas. Because, you know, they can't come here to America in any large numbers because we have our quota system, but they got to go somewhere. So, you know, be creative, figure something out. This touched upon a major machlokus among American Jews, because the Zionists would say, what is our only destination? Eretz Yisrael. What do the non-Zionists say? What is our destination? Wherever we can go. You know, that's the idea. So this is a hot button issue that harks back to Uganda in 1903, in the days of Herzl. Well, things got bad, or whether they went from bad to worse, on March 12th, 1938. The reason is because the Anschluss, that Hitler, through his various machinations, was able to arrange for the bloodless takeover of Austria. So from a Jewish point of view, that meant there are now another 175,000 Jews, mostly in Vienna, who are under the boot of the Nazis and need to get out. So it used to just be German Jewry, and a significant percentage of German Jewry actually was able to leave between 33 and 37. But what about Austrian Jews? They're stuck now. What are they going to do? So FDR wanted to do something for so-called political refugees, which was a euphemism for Jews. Now let's understand for a second why he does that. Roosevelt is not a total enemy of the Jewish people, as some people would claim. You know, he would like to see some Jews saved, including some come to America. And he facilitated that with tinkering at the margins of the immigration law. But he understands that many Americans hate Jews and don't want to see anything done specifically, you know, a policy item which is designed to help Jews. So what do you have to do? Call them by another name. So call them political refugees. I mean, anybody with a brain, with a seichel, knows what this means, but you avoid saying the word you don't want to say. Okay, well, what Roosevelt does is to unilaterally, without any approval from Congress or any other body, combine the Austrian and German quotas to now make it 27,370 annually. So the logic of it, the svara behind it is, well, Germany and Austria used to be two different countries. But they're not two different countries anymore. They're now one country. So for American purposes, there's one quota and 27,000, and we're going to fill it. We're not going to have it go half unused or two-thirds unused like in previous years. We're going to fill that quota. That's the idea. And it's going to save thousands of Jewish lives. So instructions were given to the consuls to let people proceed. Don't give them bureaucratic obstacles. Make sure that things proceed. The quota was filled for fiscal 1939. So for the year ending June 30th, 1939, every single one of those 27,370 quota spaces were filled. That's a wonderful thing. What's not so wonderful is there was an 11-year waiting list with 300,000 people waiting. And of the 300,000 people who were waiting, how many of them survived the war? Probably not so many. I mean, a substantial number, but I would imagine more than half did not survive the war. So in late March 1938, FDR announced that there would be an international conference to find solutions for the refugee problem. He didn't want to refer specifically to Jewish refugees, but when asked by a reporter if this was about the Jews, he said yes, but that a large number of Christians would also be helped. So how do you like that? The reporter asks him point blank, is this for the Jews? And he says, yes, but we're going to help some Christians too. So he has to, you know, cover his tracks a little bit. Then I want to read to you a quote from FDR, and it's very instructive. Listen, pay careful attention to the exact words of this quote. We had the matter come up at the cabinet to see if we could not do something for those unfortunate people, the Jews. But some of the cabinet members, particularly Ickes, objected on account of the immigration laws and said that it couldn't be done. Then suddenly it struck me, says Roosevelt, why not get all the democracies to share the burden? After all, they own most of the free land of the world. And there are only, what would you say, 14, 16 million Jews in the whole world, of whom half are already in the United States. So if we could divide up the remainder in groups of 8 or 10, there wouldn't be any Jewish problem in 3 or 4 generations. So what did Roosevelt just do here? The clear implication of his words were that America already had enough Jews. He doesn't want to see that many more Jews come to America. You know, a few thousand here, yeah, fine. But millions and millions, that he doesn't really have in mind. And he fudged the numbers. Were half of the world's Jews in America? No. Maybe there were 5 million Jews in America, and there are probably 19 million total in the world. He says there were 14 to 16 million, so he's playing around with the numbers. But if we could spread around the rest of world Jewry to 8 or 10 different countries, different spots in the world, then all would be well within 3 or 4 generations. So the further implication is that Jews would all assimilate and cease to exist as Jews. When he says there wouldn't be a problem in 3 or 4 generations, it means everybody would assimilate and they'd all be goyim. There'd be no more Jews. Now, more charitably, you could say that the Jews would assimilate, they wouldn't be Jewish anymore, but rather that there wouldn't be a political problem at a future time because the Jews would not be so concentrated in any one area, so that you wouldn't have, you know, virulent anti-Semitism on account of a surplus of Jews in any one place. So the thinking behind this contains kernels of unpleasant attitudes towards Jews, even while he's talking about rescuing people. Okay, now to get countries to attend this conference, FDR had to offer some stipulations. What were those stipulations? So one was no government money was expected from any nation for this resettlement project, but rather that private charitable donations we have to finance this whole endeavor. Secondly, no country would be expected to take in refugees above and beyond their existing laws and quotas. And thirdly, to lure Britain into participating in the conference, it was decided to keep Palestine off the agenda. In other words, we know the British don't want to deal with Palestine because of the Arab riots. We won't talk about it. Okay. There was a negative reaction from Republicans and even from some nativist Democrats who accused FDR of going on an excursion of altruism. I like that expression, an excursion of altruism. He's trying to be too much of a tzaddik, Roosevelt, says these, you know, the nativists. And he's forgetting about the one-third of Americans who are ill-fed, ill-clothed, and ill-housed. In other words, we have horrible poverty, rampant poverty and unemployment in America. Who does he think is this president, Roosevelt, to go on an altruism for the Jews who live in another continent? Well, Sumner Wells spoke to the press and explained that a solution to the refugee crisis would go a long way towards avoiding a future European war whose outcome nobody could predict. This was an overture to the isolationists, explaining that the movement of Jews to places of refuge would be good for America. In other words, getting the Jews out of Europe could prevent a war, and America would be sucked into that war. So if we could prevent that war by putting Jews elsewhere, then it should be good. So this was a way of a Rooseveltian Democrat telling conservative Democrats and Republicans, don't be such staunch isolationists vis-a-vis the refugees, because it's going to come back to bite you. If we don't take them in now, we're going to have to go to war later. Okay. The conference was held between July 8th and 14th in 1938, at Evian, France, on Lake Geneva. Myron Taylor, the former president of U.S. Steel Corporation, represented the United States. The big question that the conference had to address was whether or not the discussions would be limited to the Jews of Germany and Austria, or whether it would examine the wider problem of Jewish life in Europe. Fear was that if we focus on all of Europe, then other European countries will try to dump their Jews on the West. In other words, Poland with its 3 million Jews, Romania, Hungary, wherever, are going to say, oh, we don't want our Jews either. And if you guys are taking them, you take ours too. Okay. Roosevelt favored a wider scope as part of appeasement and peace. Evian happened at a time of high anti-Semitic sentiment in the United States. There was a recession and people thought Jews had too much power. There was no political advantage for Roosevelt to call for the Evian conference. There was no political advantage. Bear that in mind. For all the critics of Roosevelt who say that he hated Jews and he didn't do anything for the Holocaust, he really had no advantage in calling for this conference. Jewish groups at Evian were divided in their opinions. There was no united front. But that wasn't the biggest problem. That was a problem. Granted, it was a problem, but it wasn't the biggest problem. The biggest problem is no countries wanted Jews. Okay? And for example, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Honduras, Panama all said they didn't want traitors, with a D, not traitors, but traitors, and intellectuals. Now, traitors and intellectuals is a code word for what? Jews, okay? Who else is a traitor and an intellectual? Jews. Canada claimed that we have an unemployment crisis. We can't take anybody. Australia famously said, we don't have a racial problem, and we don't want to import one. So we don't have a racial problem, and we don't want to have one in the future. Therefore, we don't want Jews. France, the Netherlands, and Great Britain claimed that urban cosmopolitan Jews would not be a suitable fit for their tropical colonies. You know, it's near the equator. You have to have a different lifestyle. And for a Jew from Northern Europe, they're not going to fit in. There was a question in the chat. One second. Who is this from? About Eleanor Roosevelt's Jewish antenna. So Eleanor Roosevelt did not develop a pro-Jewish attitude until after the war started. In the 30s, she was still not our friend. Then she would become a big friend of the Jews from about 1942 and onward, and certainly in the 1947-48 period after she was no longer First Lady. So the only positive development at this conference was that the Dominican Republic agreed to take in 100,000 Jews. Evian established the Intergovernmental Committee on Refugees, but that organization had the unenviable task of trying to negotiate with Nazi Germany for the release of its Jews. And Nazi Germany would only release Jews if they could rob them blind and hold all Jewish money and possessions and send people out penniless. But if the Jews are going out penniless, then who's going to fund their resettlement? Nobody. The money just isn't there. And this is going to ruin any plan whatsoever. There was talk about having a Havara-style agreement with the United States, but Roosevelt himself didn't like that because he didn't want to improve Germany's war-making capacity. So he did not like the idea of paying a ransom in terms of industrial goods for the release of Jews. Meanwhile, the Munich Pact of September of 38 was denounced by American Jewry as a complete sellout. This is terrible, terrible, terrible. You know, the world is allowing Nazi aggression to go too far. No good. Appeasement went too far. Who supported appeasement in the State Department, or rather in American higher circles? Joseph P. Kennedy. Joe Kennedy, the U.S. ambassador to England. And why was he the U.S. ambassador to England? Because Roosevelt wanted him out of the country so he wouldn't have a rival domestically. You know, get this guy out of here. He's the devil. But Kennedy was part of that crowd in England that really favored out-and-out appeasement at every step of the way to avoid war and to give Germany the advantage. Kristallnacht might have helped galvanize U.S. Jewry to pressure its government to act in favor of refugees. However, and the media coverage of Kristallnacht was pretty intense. But just a few days earlier was the 1938 midterm election. And in that midterm election, the Republicans did very well. They recovered not control of any of the houses of Congress, but they recovered many, many, many seats. And FDR's hands would again be tied by a legislature that was indifferent to the human suffering in Europe. So by executive order, FDR, and claiming because Congress failed to act, declared that Jews who were on temporary visas would not have to go back to Nazi Germany. That after Kristallnacht, if you were in America, physically in America, but a Jew, you did not have to go back. And that affected several thousand people whose lives were thereby saved. This was a big chesed that Roosevelt did. Other Western heads of states, including the Canadian Prime Minister, assumed that Roosevelt had done this because of Jewish political pressure to act. They rejected it or discounted completely the possibility that Roosevelt did it for humanitarian reasons and not because of any particular political pressure. Now, the authors of FDR and the Jews, so Alan Lichtman and Richard Brightman, they have a charitable assessment of Roosevelt in this regard. And they say, no, he didn't do it because of political pressure. He did it because when it didn't hurt him politically, his inclination was to save lives if he could, as long as it didn't hurt him politically. And he was able to get away with it. Although there were members of Congress who thought this was an illegal act and tried to have it overturned. Jewish organizations, even after Kristallnacht, were afraid to bring up the topic of the quota and trying to change it by law, lest an antagonistic Congress slash the quotas at a time when the quotas were finally being used to completion. Okay. Germany doomed any effort to have a rescue package because they insisted upon the Jews leaving penniless. Government funding for this rescue plan was not to be forthcoming. Roosevelt was angry with England because at that very moment, England was contemplating the Peel Plan, which would have given the Jews a state in 5% of Eretz Israel, a disaster. And then they were restricting immigration with the White Paper. So Roosevelt is not happy with England. He suggested that Jews be allowed to settle in all of Germany's former colonial possessions, most of which were under British control. There was also an idea of allowing many thousands of Jews into Western countries right away, over and above the quotas, by mortgaging against future quotas. How do you like that? In other words, if we're allowing 27,000 a year, so then let 270,000, but you'll mortgage them now against 10 years worth of quotas, that now they'll all come and then nobody will come for the next 9 years. That was an idea. It would have required congressional approval probably, but it died a natural death. The idea was rejected. In November of 38, FDR said that America would fill its quota and in addition to that, take in some clergy and some learned professionals outside the quota, but would not change its laws. Who was entered into the United States outside the quota on the basis of that change for the clergy? Who knows?
Albert Einstein.
So he came in 33 under the intellectuals. Somebody else. Who came?
Lubavitcher Rebbe.
Lubavitcher Rebbe, correct. The Friedrich Rebbe, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe came in 1940 courtesy of that change of the law. Okay. Now, Roosevelt proposed that Jews be allowed to settle in Italian Ethiopia. Remember, Italy attacked Ethiopia in 1935 in a war of aggression. And so Roosevelt says, well, if you want to get rid of Jews, send them to Ethiopia. You know, let the Italians take care of it. The goal of that plan, it was going to fail, but it was to drive a wedge between Mussolini and Hitler. Because Mussolini, if you were to settle Jews in Ethiopia, would want them to have their money. And Hitler was insisting upon keeping all the money. So it was trying to create a breakus between the two fascists. Okay. Sentiment was growing that Jews were leading America towards war. Kennedy warned that if American Jewry did just that, they would face a pogrom in the United States. Chutzpah of him to say such a thing. The Roosevelt administration spent the second half of 1938 pursuing long shot ideas of how to get the Jews out of Greater Germany. Their second biggest obstacle after the lack of safe havens was the Nazi insistence on impoverishing the Jews. After Munich, FDR could not countenance any scheme which would materially improve Germany's war-making potential. Some claim that FDR realized that war was coming and inevitable, and that by November of 1938, he knew he would be running for an unprecedented third term. It's a question, when did Roosevelt decide to run for a third term? But yay shomrim, there are those who say that by November of 38, he already knew this is really bad, I'm going to need to stick around for a third term. And so it is possible that that's why he did not respond so forcefully after Kristallnacht in pushing Congress on the matters of refugees. Because if he had done so, he would have cost himself political support. And if he's going to run for re-election, he can't afford to lose political support. So therefore, he cannot be as open as he might have wanted to be about the issue of refugees. And so others would disagree and say, no, he just didn't care. It depends how you want to assess Roosevelt, the personality, the character. But contemporary accounts in 1938 would have argued, and argued quite fairly, that in the first 2 years of Roosevelt's second term, 37 and 38, he had been basically pro-Jewish. Because, you know, the Holocaust hasn't happened yet. Nobody knows about death camps, final solutions, anything. They just know that it's bad for Jews in Central Europe. And what? And the American Congress and the American public are against the influx of foreigners. And who is doing anything, even at the margins, to help these refugees? Well, Roosevelt. You know, so it's very tempting to destroy him and his reputation when we know all the facts at the end. But in the moment, people would have assumed he was a friend of the Jews in 37, 38. Okay, we'll stop here. I'll take a few questions. Next time, we'll try, I don't know if we're actually going to accomplish it, to get from January of 39 through the end of the war. If it takes us another two weeks instead of 1 week, so be it. We'll see how far we go. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you.
Okay, so I have a question. There was a new book written by the Wyman Institute. I've got the name of it exactly, but it's the latest one on Roosevelt and his attitude toward Jews.
Yeah.
And they cite very disparaging remarks that he made to people about Jews. I mean, in his own, you know, his own way of thinking, his own strata, his not necessarily political, but he didn't like them. He didn't like us. It's a very convincing, you know.
Roosevelt was not someone who enjoyed the company of overtly Jewish Jews, but he did not mind taking advantage of the political advice and guidance and friendship
of
people who happened to be Jewish but were really smart. So he was not a racial anti-Semite in the sense of European racial anti-Semitism. He just was an elitist WASP, an American president, but one who had no objection to having Jews hang around him all the time.
Uh-huh. But why was the Jewish Refugee Board started so late in 1943?
Okay, so when we're gonna get to that, maybe next week, maybe the week after, it was because, it was started because Morgenthau, who was his only Jewish cabinet member, insisted, after seeing the Riegner cables and proof of the final solution and what was going on in 42 and 43, that America do something to save the remnants of European Jewry, and with Hungarian Jewry being the last major community affected, you know, something could be done to rescue at least part of that community. That's why it was done, because of...
But it was late.
It was very late. We're going to see next time that the Rooseveltian answer to those who would say we have to save Jews, the answer was we have to win the war as fast as possible.
They could have bombed Auschwitz. They didn't.
Granted, there's a machlokas as to whether or not that would have actually been practically effective. There are two schools of thought on that. So the emotional school of thought says, they should have done it just as a symbolic thing, or because maybe it could have saved a few lives. The counter argument is, it would have killed people in the process, and they would have rebuilt it very quickly. We don't really know. It's in the subjunctive because it didn't happen. But you're right that explicit efforts to save Jews once the war began were non-existent until 1944. So a good 2.5 years went by of American involvement in the war when the only answer was, let's win the war as fast as possible. Any other questions?
I'd just like to add on that last comment, if I may. This is a military aircraft strategy of why they did or did not choose to bomb Auschwitz and other places. But we can deal with that in the weeks to come, of course.
Yes. Okay, anybody else? Oh, so on that note, we'll stop here. We ran a little late tonight. See everybody next week. Take care.
All right.
Thank you.